This is Corolla Digital.
Welcome to another Dr. Drew podcast. I'm here with CNN's great Aaron Burnett. So thank you for joining me.
Good to be with you, Dr. Drew.
So I don't know much about you. I don't think a lot of people do. Where'd you grow up?
I get nervous. I'm like, oh no, we're going to the personal territory.
Well, if you want to. If you want to have to, we could talk about Jodi Arias too.
Yeah,
if you want to. I know a little bit about her.
I'm not a good expert on that. No, I grew up in Eastern Shore of Maryland in total farm country. So I grew up on a farm. My dad wasn't actually a farmer, but we corn, soybean, we get fresh cantaloupe from the field in the
siblings?
Summer.
Siblings? Do you have siblings?
Two sisters.
Did they make you guys work in the fields and on the farms? And
we did lots of, well, I did. I had to cut all the grass, and I had to paint the fence, and there was a lot of fence around the farm.
Tom Sawyer.
So every single summer, yeah, you had to scrape
Sawyer
the fence.
Burnett.
You had to do the bleach to get the mold off the fence, then you had to primer the fence, and then you had to do the fence.
What did your dad do?
My dad was a lawyer.
And lawyer he put and you guys on a farm. How interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that something he did sort of later in his career? Or?
Well, no. He met my mother in New York. And he's from the Eastern Shore of Maryland, although his dad was in the Navy, so he grew up in a lot of different places. But anyway, he wanted to run for Congress, so that's why they moved down there right before my oldest sister was born.
Oh, how interesting.
And he didn't win, but he stayed.
And did you go to law school?
No, but I thought about it.
I bet.
I grew up with fighting around the dinner table, right, with lawyer.
right. A lot of families do that as sort of sport, and a lot of families feel – a lot of people who don't grow up around that feel very hurt if somebody's, like, arguing with them or has a different opinion or raises their voice.
Totally.
But no, that's sort of dinner. That's just dinner for you.
I thought about it. I mean, I kind of for a while thought that's what I would do, and I had these dreams of, social justice or foreign service, and my dad said, if you want to be a lawyer, go to law school. Don't go to law school because you think it's a good degree to have to do something else.
I've heard that. Told me that also because my kids are trying to figure out what they want to do. And Gloria Allred said that.
I said,
even if they had a law degree, they could do lots of things with it to put them at the head of the line for law. She's like, no, you'll be a lawyer if you go to law school.
That's really interesting. Yeah. She said that. Yeah, you got to want to do that. Plus, because you put so much money into it and time. And
God, but these days, what kids, I mean, there's so few jobs and more training seems to put kids ahead, even if they don't need the training. It just sort of looks good on a resume. It's really it's bad times to be young and
graduating.
Yeah. Where'd you go to college?
I went to a small school called Williams College up in Massachusetts.
Well,
I
went to a small school that had Lord Jeff as the...
No way.
Oh, yes.
I did not know that.
Oh, yes.
You did? You went to Amherst.
So for those that don't know what we're talking about, these are two major rival schools. I have family there now. And my hell would freeze over before he would become an Eefman.
Yep.
However you guys pronounce it, whatever your purple cows are all about.
I mean, Lord Jeff's is a better name than purple cows.
Well, not by much, by the way. Adam Crowley used to quip. He goes, what is that school you went to for Little Lord Fauntleroy for albino hemophiliacs?
Yeah,
what is that school?
Yeah.
Because, and it's not well known in the West either. I mean,
but that's pretty amazing. I mean, it's a great school.
It was an amazing experience. I mean,
I have to say, we rarely lost to you in sports. But yeah, it's all right.
Well, I'm a little older than you, and I would say the same thing to you during my years there. So, and now it's game on with the sports at both these schools too, because they're so
both.
Selective, they can start to pick athletes now too.
Yeah,
which is crazy. But for me, it was formative. I mean, it was really formative because you are ground down until your brain kicks in at those schools.
Yeah, I guess it really forces you. And it's really – because they're small, right? Amherst is just as small as Williams.
Yeah, they're crawling up your tush all the time.
That's right.
And there's no getting away from it. There's no easy way out. There's no, I'm going to take an easy class. I mean, if you could find one, maybe you could.
Yeah.
I'm testing your mic. I'm talking to that mic.
One, two, three. Okay, good.
So anywhere after Williams, did you think about anything?
I did. I thought I was thinking I would do international relations degree because I was thinking,
was
foreign service,
Hopkins
CIA.
Then,
I wasn't sure. I was thinking about maybe going over to Oxford or Cambridge because I'd done my junior year at Cambridge.
Oh, okay.
And it was a really amazing experience.
How was that?
For me? I loved it. I loved it. It was the spring because I played sport in the fall.
What'd you play?
I played field hockey and loved it. But it was a wonderful experience being overseas.
And you had probably one professor for each class, one student, one professor kind of ratios.
Yeah, it was really small. Yeah. And you got to, because of the way the British system is you would take a class at a different college. So we weren't, when you go there to Cambridge, you're affiliated with King's College or something.
Yeah.
But for us, we got to do a school classes at Christ College, Jesus College, King's College. Anyway, so you could see each of the different ones.
What kind of stuff did you study?
You know, it was interesting. I was looking at my cleaning out my boxes in my parents' house recently, and I was just going through all that stuff. There was a whole thing as the EU, the Maastricht Treaty. The EU was this 1997. You know, was starting to come. It was before the euro and all of that. So it was really amazing to think about how we were learning about that.
You were watching the thing to come together that we now know.
And it was, as you know, the changes going on in China and the Soviet Union and the different models of communism was another course. So it was pretty interesting when I think about it. And just the view that I learned from learning it from Europeans as opposed to the same class being taught here.
Of course.
So I thought it was a really great experience.
And then how did television come in?
So that is an interesting story. I graduated, so I thought I was going to do foreign service and all, but I decided, you know what? I need to go out and work. So I went to investment banking. You know why? Because just like you said with
Lars. A lot of kids did from those
schools. Go do it because it's good for your resume and you learn something.
Kids, that's sort of a route from some of those small schools. Particularly if you're studying, if you study any economics, everyone's sort of heading that direction. Mm-hmm.
So I went to Goldman Sachs. I knew nothing about finance. All these kids from Wharton undergrad.
Right.
They have an undergrad. These kids, it's like they breathe spreadsheets.
Could you
I'm
keep
like,
up?
What is Excel?
but you probably learned it real fast.
You know, they give you a course.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, I mean, I think that their background is great, but I would do the liberal arts again if I could because there's a critical thinking.
But I absolutely agree with you. And yet that kind of education is under attack right now.
Liberal arts.
Oh, my kids are in college. And if you go to college and you say, here's the track I'm going to follow as opposed to – I'm going to study liberally. People go, well, you're not going to get a job if you study liberally. Please don't.
Really? So it's learn this skill or go down and get this kind
skills
of specialty?
Absolutely. About specializations that are going to be outdated in 3 years for sure. So once again, we're back to not teaching kids how to think.
That's very problematic.
It's very problematic. And it's getting worse and worse and worse and worse. I've pushed my kids liberal studies, and they're not sure from their perspective. They're not sure I've done them right. You know what I mean?
It's hard, too, because everyone around them is doing something different.
That's right. So. And I'm saying, no, you just figure it out later. Right now you learn how to think. You learn how the world works. You learn how to study. You learn how to write and read, and that's it.
Yeah. Wow.
It's a lost art. I'm telling you.
That's scary.
Yeah, yeah.
I never ended up going back to graduate school. I did the Goldman thing.
Goldman Sachs to?
I ended up, after an all-nighter, my brother-in-law saw a New York Times article. Front of the business section had a picture of Willow Bay, who was getting an anchor job at a show called Moneyline here on CNN.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I wrote Willow a letter, not actually asking for a job, but maybe in the back of my head that's what I was thinking, but I was very curious. And her assistant wanted to leave and go become a Broadway actress, which she did, by the way, incredibly successful. And so she said, Willow, take a look at this woman's resume, right? She's, you know, knows banking and finance. And so I came in to work for Willow.
Oh, how fantastic. What a great story. See, that's how jobs should happen. You know
and
I mean?
She became a mentor of mine, and she ended up – so I became a writer on that show.
Let's talk about this business we're in here. Is it everything you hope? Is it satisfying? Well, people can't see she's smirking at me, but you know what's interesting about talking to you, Aaron, is I get the same feeling I get from you that I get from Anderson, and I know is my sort of instinct or deepest held feeling is – media, you know, television is just something we use to try to make a difference. And we're in this organization, CNN, HLN, and it reaches lots of people, and we can use it to try to make a difference.
Yeah.
Is that where you're at?
I mean, that is why we're all doing it. And, of course,
some people are just journalists. Some people just like being on TV. You know what I mean?
Well, that's true.
Yeah. And,
that's
true. There's a lot of that out there.
There is. But, I mean, for me it is. It's about – and you can make a difference in ways you don't even realize. I think that's the most humbling part about it.
Yeah.
You know, coming with our territory, you want to make a difference in a way that also sometimes is not, but sometimes is entertaining, right? I mean, you have to have people be excited and be interested in watching. But we do have this,
if you don't have the eyes, you can't deliver the information.
Then you can't make the difference, you know, but one of the things.
That's the creative sort of challenge, right?
That's right. It's trying to do both. Yeah. Recently we were, I've been really wanting to go to do the Mali story.
Mali?
The Al-Qaeda, the rise of Al-Qaeda in Mali in Northern Africa.
Oh.
And only at CNN could I have done that. And so they let me go, and we were able to go to the border up where, you know, these guys were.
Literally Timbuktu.
Well, I wasn't in Timbuktu.
Yeah. But people don't know, that's where this
all
was going down.
The north of Mali is where this was all going down, right? And we went to a refugee camp along the border. in Burkina Faso and met all these refugees, and we were, you know, driving around, and right after we left where we were, there was kind of like a flood. Mm. And on the other side of the floodwaters, so they couldn't cross, you know, the next day came these guys with all these guns mounted in the back of their truck. But, you know, to me it was because of being at CNN, we were able to make a difference, not just in terms of awareness for the national security issue of it, which is near and dear to me because of my interest in international relations, and I think it's important for the U.S., but also to raise awareness for what was happening to the people in Mali. There's a bigger refugee situation by multiples than Syria. And that doesn't, it's not to say Syria isn't crucial and important, because of course it is, but just that we could also be aware of this and what these people,
the suffering that these people were going through was pretty incredible
to see.
These were apparently really glorious and joyous people at one time, not just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I listen to BBC every night when I'm driving home. And,
love the BBC.
Yeah, and I'm always shocked at how little information about Africa gets here. And how much the rest of Europe is really focused on that.
I mean, and I love doing Africa, and it's hard. People still perceive it to kind of be one thing and one story. I mean, in this country, the image of it is still, you know, the poverty or the distended belly.
Yeah.
And there are lots of issues still in Africa, but the story of the entrepreneurialism and the middle class that is growing in certain places. It's an incredible story.
We have no idea about that.
I mean,
there's a very educated class.
I was in Nigeria. Yep. Nigeria is the New York of Africa.
I know. They're super
educated. My gosh. Yeah. They're crazy. They're running around. There are always so many ideas going on, like so invigorating.
Yep.
And I keep saying to people, gosh, if you could share more of that, it will change people's view of the world in a really good way.
We are weirdly myopic about that continent.
I totally agree.
To our own detriment, for sure, if we don't pay attention. Yeah. But it's interesting, as I'm getting a feeling of what's important to you, myself, it's individuals and their health and their well-being and flourishing and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I'm getting the real sense for you, it is the world and our country's place in the world. Would that
be
accurate?
Yes, that's exactly right. I'm glad if you got that out of it, then I'm doing okay.
Okay, well, but yeah. I didn't know that about you until we sat down here. And so my question then is, tell me, where are we? Where do you think we are? Because I sit and I worry and I wring my hands, but I have no ability or way to really, other than my own sort of body's response to the trends in the world, I kind of feel what's going on. I have no cognitive, objective way to evaluate things.
I mean, I don't know. You know, I mean, I'm always so torn. But, you know, and I have this map up that I'm looking at in my office. That's my map of countries with a little...
It's the world.
Yeah, I put the little pins in when we go someplace. I think that, look, it's tough. The United States has to, you know, we want to be a benign
superpower.
You've
never been to Los Angeles, by the way? It's not
No,
on your...
I only do the capitals.
Okay.
I only do the capitals.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, I worked out there for a while.
Okay.
But... Yeah, I think that the world needs stability. Let me give you an example of why I think the United States, it's important that we figure out how to remain a superpower as best we can. So you look at the sea, right? Most of the world is water.
Yep.
90% of the goods that we ship right now go by water.
Yeah.
Oil, if you buy at Walmart, still goes by ship.
Right.
So the safety of the seas is really the stability of our economy and our entire lives.
Yes.
The safety of the seas around the planet is provided by the United States right now. That's Pax Americana, is that we provide that safety, right? NATO is on us. You know, the reason Europe was able to cut back so much in its defense is because of us. We don't allow South Korea to have nuclear weapons because of us. Japan, right? We've done that. Now, you may think that that's good. You may think that that's not good. But one thing that it's done is create a very stable world.
Mm.
So as the United States power inevitably wanes, perhaps, or even if it doesn't wane, it can still grow. I mean, I believe in a pie where the U.S. can keep getting stronger, but China can also,
bigger.
Right?
Yeah.
Everybody can get bigger. This doesn't have to be a game where the U.S. has to fall. But in a world where everybody's getting bigger, there are going to be some tension points, and there's going to be some issues, and I think that's a challenge for us.
And,
plus, we may get deals with a lot of people that aren't good people.
And so always
look at the Middle East. We do that. And then
it backfires on us every time.
And it backfires. And then, you know, we want to act like we're for democracy when we were for dictators before. And we don't understand why people are frustrated with us.
And then we don't understand what democracy means for countries that try to establish democracy. Because I mean, if you read Tocqueville, not to get too heady here, but, you know, we have a discipline of democracy. We live in it. Even when we're first grade, we elect class presidents and we elect
things. Part of who we are.
And his whole point, I don't know if you've read Democracy in America, but his whole thing was, these Americans, they live with this thing all the time, so it's in them. It's not a concept that they have to kind of make their own. It's always part of their life.
Right.
And you don't think about that very often, but it's here. You know, and we're, you know, you and I are sitting here talking in New York City. This city still attracts and is as vibrant as ever. I mean, to me, it's sort of, this city's telling in certain ways about what's going on in the world, in this country.
Well, it's amazing, too, because, you know, you hear all this frustration, you know, in the United States. What are we doing about our debt and taxes and all of these things?
I'm on that, by the way. I'm very frustrated on that, but go ahead.
And then you look at the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And you look at New York City, and one of the strange things about New York City is these people who, I mean, these incredibly wealthy people from wherever they're from around the world still sees the United States as a safe haven for their money.
Yeah.
You got places like France where, you know, Francois Hollande is pushing for a 75% tax.
Yep.
So
well, how about Cyprus? You can just reach in your pocket.
Right.
Take money.
I mean,
right,
we
out
have
of it.
Our problems, but yeah. we are the world's fiat currency. And the gift that that gives us is just unbelievable. And so people, all these people and other are putting their money here in the United States, especially here in New York.
Do you think that the finance system here will continue to prevail? I mean, you were in the middle of it. I mean, Goldman Sachs was the heartbeat of
the
all
banks
this.
Are all bigger than they were before they were too big to fail.
Yeah.
Which, you know, this is just a statement.
You're talking about 2008? Are you talking about
before the whole crisis happened, and then, you know, the whole thing was it can't
now.
Be too big to fail.
Yeah,
we're going to break them up. Now they're bigger.
They're bigger, but they have tons of capital sitting on the side. That's the
they
only
do,
difference.
But, you know, I mean, do you think it'll be – I mean, I don't know. I just – you know, it is what it is. The government would have to bail those guys out.
Say that again? You think there's going to be a collapse or something?
No, I just say if there were to be a problem, I mean, these guys
are – Well, they sort of learned that from Lehman, right? They don't want to let that happen again.
Right.
Everyone
and
agrees.
They try to say it won't. But you know,
were you
the
there
US
when
has a
that
lot
all
of,
went down?
Yeah.
You were on Wall Street when that all went down?
I was covering Wall Street.
You were not actually working there then?
No, I was at CNBC.
Did you see it coming? Right. Did you see it coming?
Well, I mean, you started to see – I'm not going to pretend I saw it, but everyone knew there was a housing bubble. The question was, you know, do people think it would burst to the extent it burst? And
not only burst, but I don't know if people are aware, but like the money markets froze that for a couple of days. That's
we didn't
thing
think we could get money out of the ATM. Do you remember that
I
fear?
Do that. People forget
the
that.
The fear in your stomach when that
Well,
I mean,
I don't think the world quite got that because people don't reach into the money market on a daily basis. But when your friends in finance go, if you wanted to get your money out of the money market, I'm not sure it's not there. Is it there? It might be there. It's frozen.
No.
That was profound.
Yeah.
But we got through that.
We did, which is amazing. And we did it because of trust in our institutions
and
our system.
Is it that or what? Well, okay, I agree with you. And do you think Paulson did a good job by choosing the numbers he chose and throwing cash the way he threw it?
Well, I mean, I'm sure, you know, he's working, you know, I'm sure there could have been things that were done better. But the bottom line of TARP, now his original way of doing TARP was probably better than the way he was forced to do TARP. But when you look at all the big banks, they have paid back their TARP with interest.
Yeah.
So it's not as if we lost money.
The government
By the
has
way,
made money on lots of these TARP actions.
People may not realize this, but it's GM.
Made a ton of money on that, right?
GM's not paying us.
They made money off one of the – I thought GM, they made a ton of money on the bonds or something.
They might have made money on certain parts of it, but all in, we're still in the red on GM.
Okay.
Now, we could end up – that could end up changing. You know, I don't know. A lot of experts say no, but – and that doesn't mean we shouldn't have done it. Some things you just do because they're the right thing to do.
You had to
but,
do it,
But the banks, you know, they have paid back. So if you could say he could have structured it better or however you want to say that. But, you know, if you're looking at it on just a factual, absolute basis, they did pay it back.
So here you are at Ground Zero. You're in Goldman Sachs, and then you're at CNBC.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're over here, I suppose, by the time the Occupy Wall Street thing hit. Is this all territory that you can talk about?
Sure.
Is it? How do you understand all that? Maybe that's the way to ask it.
I mean, I think the country went through a period of great excess, and the people who benefited the most from it on Wall Street didn't understand what everybody else was going through. And I think that was what the backlash
was. So it's insolence.
I think, right, it was perceived that way, and I think a lot of people didn't understand it. And I think that lack of sensitivity is what caused the frustration and anger that people have.
Is that still going on with our politicians, do you think?
Well, I mean, our politicians, you know, gosh, I mean, what could be more frustrating? I think
than being a politician or dealing with politicians?
Well, I wouldn't be a politician if you paid me. But I mean, a lot of them just, they think that their job is, well, I was elected to do this, to buy this pen, so I'm going to buy this pen. That's all I'm going to do.
Right,
I'm not
going
to negotiate with you on this. I'm going to only do this.
Right.
And so that ends up leading to a lot of bad things. But, you know, there are some really good people still in Washington.
People expect me to also talk about you and your life and stuff. Are your parents still around? Are you still
parents,
close with them?
My parents are, and my two sisters are. I got seven nieces and nephews.
Are you in a relationship now?
Mm-hmm, married.
You're married, mm-hmm. And kids or
no? I just got married in December.
Is that a plan or?
Yep, I hope so.
It will change everything. You need to talk to me when that happens.
look, let
I'm
me just tell you this. Let me just tell you this. I hope it isn't triplets. I know it would be great joy that you had.
No,
I don't want triplets.
Oh, no. oh, you do not want to do that. Listen, our obstetrician sat down.
How do you change all the poopy diapers at the same time?
Well, I'll tell you a story. I literally, it was early days. I was just doing radio, I think one day a week back then. Somebody actually wanted me to do a television pilot. This is 20 years ago. And I was like, what does that mean? What is that? I'll show up, whatever. And, hang on. My wife's yelling at me before I run out because it was like 7 o'clock at night. They sort of squeezed it in after I was done with practice.
You thought this was like a routine, getting your ultrasound for whatever?
No. This is now, they're already born. They're already in.
Oh, they're born.
And now we're filming a television pilot, which I didn't know what that meant. And I didn't know what.
Right.
I'm practicing medicine from 5 in the morning until 10 at night most days. But they squeeze this thing in at 7 o'clock at night. And my wife's like, yeah, before you go, change Jordan's diaper. You know, so I'm changed. I know another one's messed. I'm changing diapers. And during my change, I guess I did that. And
you just put your hands through your hair.
I put my hands through my hair, and I walk in to get the makeup, and they're like, what is all this in your hair?
Oh, my God.
Oh, it was baby diarrhea, just completely
something about Mary. That kind of like yellowish color.
Oh, yeah. Something about Mary ain't got nothing on me. I had baby poo in my hair. And it was like, oh, well, because we were up to our chest in poo all the time. But I'll tell you, the obstetrician told us, he sat us down. We saw the first ultrasound, and I could read ultrasounds enough to know that there was more than one in there. And I was like, oh, my God. And the first words out of my mouth were, how are we going to pay for college? And my wife has never forgiven me for that. She felt like that was very insensitive. But it was literally like, I literally have been sitting in the doctor.
Yeah, but that's what, I understand that's a fear.
As a dad, just worry about it. I still don't know how we're going to do it. We're halfway into it. And he sat us down about 2 weeks later. And we actually had quads to begin with. One resorbed spontaneously. And she sat us down. He sat us down and he said, don't do this. He goes, I will get you 3 healthy babies, but the probability of your marriage surviving, the probability of the emotional health and physical health of babies being jeopardized is very high. Have twins, reduce. It was intense. So we had to sit there. And we don't really believe in abortion. We don't choose that.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we were trying to choose on behalf of a well-being for others, we could not do it. We decided we cannot do it. We're going all in. We're like, all our chips are going in. We're going to do the triplet thing. And it worked for us. But, man, it was tough. I do not recommend it.
Wow.
Do it the old-fashioned way, one at a time, I will hook you up with my wife. She's really good. We can change diapers.
Hopefully no twins run in my family.
We can change diapers like nobody's business.
Yeah.
Do you live in the city now? Is that?
I live in the city.
And your husband, is he?
He is from New Jersey, so he's the local.
And what's his business?
He works in the bond market.
So did you guys meet down there? No,
we didn't actually. Yeah. I had left. I was in media when I met him through a friend. So
wasn't a lot of the bond business destroyed in 9/11, or at least the actual physical, the people that were in the bond business?
Yeah, there was a firm, Cantor Fitzgerald, mm-hmm. that just a horrible story. But the people who survived that have given a lot back to that community and done a lot.
So it's been rebuilt and
it was a pretty. That was a. You know, scarring event for a lot of people in that mm-hmm. who worked there were in that industry or peripherally in that industry.
Is this town recovered? I mean, you look down Broadway now and you see the tower, the Freedom Tower, rises up. Now it scares me to see it down
it's
there.
So strange. You know, you say that. I was thinking the other day, I'm trying to remember what movie it was, but I was watching a movie and it was filmed before.
Mm.
And I saw them in the background. Mm. And, you know, I remember the weekend before 9/11, I was actually at the U.S. Open, so I was out. In Queens, they're at the Rush Stadium, and I have a picture of me and a good friend of mine. He and I went, and they're there, and it made me think of that. You know, that they used to just be a part
wherever you looked, whenever you look
for the
down,
world, New York City, and now
whenever you look downtown, there they were,
not.
Boom, always there.
And when you see them, you bring with this, you know, and it's for us, you know, who were alive at that time. I was 7 blocks away that morning, so I heard the first one and watched the second one.
Oh my God, I didn't know. I'm sorry. You never get over that.
It's a life-defining moment for – makes you realize in every generation that has a life-defining moment that they have one, and that was mine.
Well, I could talk to you all day, and knowing that you come from – you hearken from the little Ivy, the little three.
Little three.
Is deeply important to me.
I love
so
it. Now I know you
that.
Went to Amherst, because as anyone who is listening who happened to go to either knows, you hate each other when you're there, but afterwards you have a special bond.
That's exactly right. You know, oh my God, we have more in common. We have more in common with our Williams brethren and sistren than anyone else. So.
Totally.
But thank you, Aaron. We will watch you on CNN, and there's new news. Do you want to discuss it? This will probably air in about 2 weeks. Any new news? Okay.
No.
Okay. Nothing new. And Aaron is somebody that is she's always been very gracious to me, and she says hello. You're one of the ones that say hi to me every time I come out here to New York, and I really do appreciate it.
Well, we love having you.
And I love Aaron. I love watching Aaron. I hope you all will too. So we'll see you next
time. Thank you, Dr. Drew. Okay.
Digital.